It's Sam Cedar launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
Folks, this episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Ting.com. Ting gives you big savings and billing clarity for mobile phone service. Try their online savings calculator right now and save $50 on your device purchase at MajorityReport.ting.com.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, October 17th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Digby from the blog Hullabaloo on last night's debate. Yes, Obama strikes back. Also on the program, women for the first time, either more likely than men to place a higher importance in valuing a high-paying career, or at least younger women versus younger men. Ohio voting law, or I should say not voting law, will continue to be overturned, I guess is the best way. And there will be early voting in Ohio, another win for voting advocates. We got some swing state polls. We have an overturning of the Hamdan conviction. Apparently, you can't go back in time and convict something of something that didn't become illegal until afterwards. I'll explain that the best I can in just a moment. First off, however, you know, today we sat down and we were trying to figure out who we were going to have on to do some post-debate analysis, and had no ideas until we heard this clip from Mitt Romney. This is clip number one.
And I said, "Well, gosh, can't we find some women that are also qualified?" And so we took a concerted effort to go out and find women who had backgrounds that could be qualified to become members of our cabinet. I went to a number of women's groups and said, "Can you help us find folks?" And they brought us whole binders full of women. I was proud of the fact that after I staffed my cabinet and my senior staff, that the University of New York in Albany did a survey of all 50 states and concluded that mine had more women in senior leadership positions than any other state in America. Now, one of the reasons I was able to get so many good women to be part of that team was because of our recruiting effort.
Yes, it was the recruiting efforts. And so I said to Matt Binder, who is our one of our producers, bring me the binder. And so we're going to have Digby on today. But it turns out that this story about Mitt Romney, not exactly true. I'm just so shocked. I don't even know. I don't even know what to say.
Surprise, surprise.
It turns out that, no, Mitt Romney didn't turn to his pals once he got in office and said, bring me the binder of women so that I may hire more women. No, in fact, according to David Bernstein writing in the Phoenix, What actually happened was that in 2002, prior to the election, not even knowing yet whether it would be a Republican or Democratic administration, a bipartisan group of women in Massachusetts formed MassGap to address the problem of few women in senior leadership positions in state government. They created the binder and handed it to the incoming governor at the time. So maybe a slight distinction, small fib by Mitt Romney. Of course, according to Bernstein, he did appoint 14 women out of his first 33 senior level appointments, but they were all in agencies he didn't care about. And it also raises the question, how is it that a guy who had been working in business for 25 years in senior management, balancing budgets, doing all the nitty gritty, saving the Olympics, never came across one woman he thought was qualified to serve in his administration? Thank God for binders.
Also, throughout his administration, there was a decline, a progressive decline throughout his administration of women working under him.
Yes, there ended up being less women than at the beginning. But, you know, let's not get nitpicky. Sometimes the binders are not, the binders don't show up. All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Digby from the blog Hullabaloo. This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Ting. Ting is a new mobile service that makes sense. It's all about bringing clarity, usability, and big savings to mobile phone users. It's built on the Sprint network. It has a simple plan with honest, fair pricing that bills megabytes, minutes, and text messages separately. So if you use less than you're anticipated, you automatically credited the difference at the end of the month. If you use more, you automatically billed for the additional amount. Ting.com has no premiums, no penalties. You don't pay for more than you use. They offer 4G Android phones through Sprint. Ting means big savings, and they've got great customer support. So you don't have to wait. You can get on the phone between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Email support is also great. The company is run by geeks. So if you have any type of problem with your mail or whatever it is, technical problems with your hardware, they're going to be able to help you out. If you go to majorityreport.ting.com today, right now, majorityreport.ting.com, check out their usage calculator, see how much money you're going to save, and you'll get $50 off a piece of hardware. If you buy a device, a phone, you'll get $50 off for being a Majority Report listener. Ting, it just makes sense. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Digby from the blog Hullabaloo at digbysblog.blogspot.com. Welcome, Digby.
Oh, thanks for having me, Sam.
So the big debate last night, everybody was wondering, would the President Obama that didn't show up in the last debate show up in this debate? And what say you, as Bill O'Reilly would say?
Well, it certainly wasn't the same Obama. I mean, he obviously had a couple of espressos before he went on, which he should have had before. And, you know, he seemed really engaged. And I had always thought that he would probably do pretty well in this format. He's done a ton of town halls over the last, how long has he been on the national stage? It's 6 years.
Right.
You know, doing tons of them. Not that Romney hasn't been doing them either, but my recollection is that Obama does pretty well in those situations, and that Romney, on the other hand, isn't quite as engaging. You know, he's just not, he's a robot, so he doesn't, it's kind of hard for him to appeal to real people. Although last night I thought he did better than I had seen him do before on a theatrical, purely theatrical basis. So, you know, I wasn't entirely surprised that Obama came back. And needless to say, the pressure was on Obama to perform. And, you know, he's a talented professional politician. I assumed that he was going to get his act together and do better. And you know, frankly, I think he did. I mean, he was pretty good last night. And if we agree, and I think that there is some merit to this, that the theatrical side of debates are important. I mean, we'd like to believe that these are all, we're all sitting there intently listening to the answers and, you know, taking notes and running spreadsheets on, you know, what it all means to us personally. I think people have a pretty sophisticated, you know, heuristic sense that, you know, they kind of size these people up, comparing them one-on-one with each other on a, you know, a fairly subliminal level. So it's important how they appear and their confidence and their ability to parry the other side and to, you know, show empathy or whatever else it is that people care about. And you know, in that regard, I thought it was a pretty successful debate for Obama and, you know, not a bad one for Romney. He wasn't as bad as, you know, he didn't start break into America the Beautiful. So,
right.
I mean, I guess, you know, he didn't completely drop the ball. And in fact, if he had a problem, it's in the fact checking that's happening today.
Right. And the fact that fact checking can actually happen as opposed to sort of focusing on the performance of the president. And I largely agree. I mean, I think, look, you know, people have to remember Mitt Romney's been running for president for 8 years now. And if you don't have the ability to do a town hall without sort of being wheeled out of there on a gurney, then there's something horribly, horribly wrong. So let's go bit by bit if we can, because I also want to get your perspective, not only in terms of how President Obama did relative to his campaign, but I want to also make sure that we get into how President Obama did in terms of the perspective of people who are cautious or somewhat concerned about, you know, obviously more concerned about a President Romney, but somewhat concerned about the president's second term. But let's go through on just sort of some of that that pairing. One of the things up early, I mean, the first exchange, I got to admit, had me a little bit concerned because you had Romney get up there basically extolling the virtues of things like Pell Grants and free college education. And the reality is that his budget, certainly Paul Ryan's, but his as well, which is going to shrink revenues by providing tax cuts across the board, theoretically, and also cut the budget. Things like Pell Grants are virtually impossible under that scenario. And President Obama didn't seem really to call him out on it. I mean, by the end, I thought the president did pretty well in talking about taxes, whatnot. But it got me a little bit scared there. And then he seemed to really pick it up. Then he seemed to really go after Romney, I think, on just about, well, everything that Romney said.
Yeah, I was worried too in the beginning, and you know, frankly, I'm, you know, as one of these concerned progressives who, you know, worries about the second term, and I wrote a piece yesterday, just posted it just before the debate, talking about the fact that I, you know, there is a vision that President Obama can, could have, and you know, probably will not have an opportunity to do now because the only debate left is foreign policy. But on the, you know, to project a different image about what he, or I shouldn't say image, a different vision about what he plans to do or what his vision for America over the next 4 years is, which would have been based upon, and upon some data that is out there done by Democracy Corps and others, who when the president or when someone says, as the president, that his vision is that, you know, our problem is debt, our problem is lack of investment, it's not, you know, putting money into the things that we care about for the future for our kids and blah, 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 you know, and I put it on my blog. It's a long sentence. And I was, you know, when you do that, when you rearrange this term of where we're really starving our country, where this, you know, a deficit obsession and lowering taxes and this kind of, you know, kind of narrow focus on all this sort of, you know, cramped vision of America, this, you know, we've all got to sacrifice and tighten our belts and do this, that, and the other. When he switches that out and actually puts it in terms of how you can turn that around through growth and, you know, a more optimistic vision, people really, really like it. And when they test those messages, they do. He doesn't do that, and he hasn't done that. And in fact, if anything, you know, he, again, did the thing that makes me cringe, which is say, well, we're going to ask the rich to pay a little bit more and everybody else will have to give a little too. And that whole thing, which just, I guess they must figure it focus groups well or something, but it really grates on me. You know, as long as he keeps focused on that, I think that you know, Romney does have the better of it. He can come to the middle with and just lie, you know, just basically right. lie about his positions. And, you know, he sounds as reasonable as Obama. What's the difference? You know, just put and it's not just the lies. It's the vision itself that Romney's, of course, is phony. And Obama's is kind of, it's so focus grouped and, you know, completely without any blood in it that, you know, what's the difference? You know, so you toss it up. Having said that, you know, once they got past that moment in the debate, I think Obama, and I don't know whether this was a personal thing with Romney just right up in his face saying, yeah. you know, practically saying, I demand an answer, you know, sort of, you know, well, who the hell are you? You know, it's like, you know, who made you God? I think maybe Obama got his own blood up a little bit and decided that he wasn't going to take that. I mean, it was ridiculous.
Yeah. We'll talk about I think the moment where that really seemed to have come to the fore was on Libya, and we'll get there in a little bit. But yeah, this vision thing, it has sort of baffled me a little bit because there doesn't, you know. Romney's whole agenda, you know, although he hasn't been able to stick to his message, but it seemed to me that the best path that Romney had was to say, I'm not crazy, and President Obama just hasn't been able to execute. But we fundamentally are in the same ballpark, and that's why you should, you know, we gave him a try. He hasn't been able to execute it. And so when President Obama, particularly in the last debate, said things like, we're not that different on Social Security, it seems to me that you're leaving a real potential electoral benefit on the table. And basically almost taking it off the table. I mean, there's no room. You can't come back in the second debate and say, hey, remember when I said we were similar on Social Security? Well, actually, we're not. What do you think accounts for that? I mean, do you think this is – I mean, because – on one hand, I want to give President Obama some credit for having the integrity of, you know, if you want to cut Social Security, you're not going to say that you want, you know what I mean? But on the other hand, it's baffling to me.
Well, it's certainly baffling politics. I don't know, but I can't figure out why he wants to do that. In any case, I mean, you know, the president right. has had, you know, he's been chasing this grand bargain white whale for 4 years, and I still don't really understand it. You know, I don't know. I was baffled by that. I mean, it was such a tactical mistake, exactly for the reasons that you said. Putting Romney in any situation where he can look like a reasonable guy is very, very foolish. The last thing you want to do. And, you know, I don't know what happened. I was very surprised that the debate moved anything because, you know, I just hasn't been my experiences that debates actually make a whole lot of difference in, you know, in elections. But it did. It really seemed to have done so. And, you know, part of it was that a huge number of people watched, which also kind of confounded me. I'm thinking, wow, you know, people are that interested. I was kind of surprised, and it made me have to think a little bit about turnout and how this election is going to go in a way that might, you know, be a little surprising compared to what I thought it was going to be. But in any case, you know, it did seem to do that. And I think that was one of the reasons that, you know, Obama – not only did Romney just shift his positions to the middle abruptly and without any kind of preamble, just come in one night and turn morph himself into someone else, But Obama let him, kind of agreed with him and went, well, yeah, you're okay. You're a good guy. You love your family. We all want the best. And, it's terrific. Boy, that exactly opened up that space that you talk about among people to say, maybe things still are kind of, messed up. So maybe we really should give the other guy a chance. He's not that bad. He's from Massachusetts. He's been liberal in the past. So maybe he'll, he won't be crazy, and that's a bad thing to do. Last night, he, I think Obama made a, made a stronger contrast, and Romney seemed a little bit, I don't know, there was an edge to him last night that I think was kind of a little bit more obvious. And he, you have to feel sorry for the guy. He does have to walk a very fine line because he's got complete nuts that are dogging him every minute of the day, and he can't go too far. But he has to give the impression that he is not as crazy as they are. That's a tough political act. I don't know why Obama, this seems to be, his original vision for, for the rationale for his candidacy in 2008 was that he was going to transcend all political differences and change the very way America was. I mean, on a fundamental basis, people were going to start working together, agreeing with one another. He was, this is part of what I wrote about yesterday, was that, my recollection of that was everyone I asked during that campaign was, what do you think he really cares about? And people knew. And it was, he cares about changing Washington. He cares about, being bipartisan. He cares about, a postpartisan vision. Every once in a while,
no red states, no blue states. I mean, that's what his 2004.
That was, and I think that's what he really, that was his rationale. Well, that rationale clearly was didn't work out. Okay,
right.
And he can't use that again. And I think he's been scrambling ever since then for a real vision, because that was the vision. It was always a fantasy. People wanted to believe it. It was a beautiful symbolic thing that he was the first black president, and he embodied that idea in so many ways. But in practical political terms, we are in a gritty trench warfare, two sides fighting for dominance and the vision of how our government is supposed to operate. And that is not Obama. So I think he's been struggling. I was hopeful that after that debate where he kind of, conceded all that, tried to make that argument sort of tepidly again, and it really didn't work, that he would recognize rather late that he was going to have to present a different vision. He didn't do that last night, but he did at the very least show that they, recognize that he was going to have to fight for this job.
Right.
And, in some ways, maybe that's enough.
Yeah, I mean, I think it certainly was enough last night. I mean, I think your point about President Obama, sort of his agenda in 2008 was at its heart, ultimately, more of a process agenda, that we're going to change the way that we do things, as opposed to change things to a certain, with a certain outcome in mind. That to a large extent that explains, sort of the pursuit of the grand bargain, right? I mean, because the grand bargain is really the one of, forget about what the details are. The idea of making a grand bargain really is the culmination, the consummation of that desire to no red states, no blue states. We can come together. And that's, definitionally speaking, sadly for the rest of us, it's usually just when wealthy people and wealthy interests can agree can shake off their electoral constraints, they can come together in that way. One of the things, focusing on Romney's tightrope act, where I saw this the most, and I thought it was sort of the strangest, was his response on Lilly Ledbetter. Because, his answer in that situation was, and we play the clip of course, of the binder, which sadly turns out to be a fake story. But he can't even say, it seems to me that you could say there's 20 different responses if you don't believe that government should address that pay disparity. You could say Lilly Ledbetter really hasn't had the effect that that people hoped it has, and this shows that government can't necessarily do this, and that what we need is a better understanding of flexibility in general. But all he could basically say is, like, let me prove to you that I think women are not bad people. it's just bizarre to me.
Well, his discomfort with the topic was so obvious, and I am sure that, you know, anyone watching who has any feeling for that subject felt that. You know, this is a guy who is not comfortable with that. And, you know, it apparently, you know, when he was at Bain, no partners were women. And, of course, the field that he works in that, you know, that sort of venture capital world is very, very low on women. It's just not a female friendly. It's a real boys club, which that picture of him with his partners and the money coming out of their mouths and pockets kind of shows what the ethos of that particular field is. You know, he does not have a feeling for this. He is obviously a very traditional man, from, you know, quite old school. He has, you know, his wife kind of shows how, you know, the life that he's had sort of shows that. And he is, I think he is literally incapable of understanding how, you know, women or modern males of all ilks think about this. And to him, that's just, it's like asking him about life on Mars. He just has no way of relating to it. And it's a real problem for him. I'll be very interested to see how the polls, if the polls move, again, because after the first debate, a lot of women moved toward Romney, which was kind of a frightening thought. But what they saw was a guy who, you know, seemed fairly reasonable, nice man, nice family. I'm sure that there were plenty of women who didn't see the threat from him. I'll be interested to see if they see it differently after this, because I felt, and obviously I'm not exactly unbiased here, but, you know, I really felt that he muffed that and that he made, a major sort of, heuristic error in not, obviously he hadn't practiced that well enough with his right. theatrical coaches. And I think he came off pretty badly.
One of the things that I found a little bit sort of troubling, you know, and it goes along with what you were saying about President Obama talking, you know, about the deficit, and there just seems like to be moments, and I guess this is just the way it is, and I shouldn't let this get under my skin, but, you know, this sort of argument of like, hey, we're drilling the hell out of this country, and Romney going, well, you're not Mr. Coal, you're not Mr. Oil, and you're not Mr. Natural Gas. President Obama saying, well, I'm close, and this sort of the danger here, and I guess this gets back to the point about the sort of, there's not really a full-throated vision one way or another. It just seems to be like, not going to allow my opponent to outflank me on anything. And in the end, it's problematic because you lose some type of, I don't know, I guess there's a question as to whether or not the bully pope of the presidency has any type of import whatsoever. Only Frank Santelli, I guess, that guy who, right. The CNBC guy, he's the only guy with a real bully pope because he can start the whole Tea Party movement off of one TV broadcast. But it seems to me that there's not just a missed opportunity. There's a real danger here going forward because there's no advocacy for the idea of, like, it's deluded to want to be Mr. Oil, Mr. Coal, and Mr., you know, Natural Gas.
Yeah, no kidding. And look, I mean, this is not unprecedented. This was very dangerous, I thought, last night. I sent a chill down my spine because this is truly going to the heart of perhaps the most issue facing humankind, which is climate change. And the fact that we are now seeing the Democrats kind of go the way of, gun control, right. death penalty. You know, we used to have a whole bunch of issues that we fought on and have since given up the ghost. And this one seems to be moving in that direction. That is very scary. The fact that there was no mention of climate change, for one thing, and particularly in this context, which, you know, to my way of thinking, aside from, you know, obviously, you know, Obama's, you know, rule number one is he's got to try to win the election. But at the same time, he's the president of the United States, and he does have an obligation to, you know, take the forum that he's in and educate the American people about what the stakes in all this are. It wouldn't have hurt to have put that in there, because most people do believe climate change, and the people who don't are not going to vote for him. So, you know, this is that's a very frightening prospect to me, that I'm seeing the Democrats move into this, you know, yes, drill, baby, drill, we're just going to, you know, do whatever we can. You know, sure, they'll tweak it a little bit around the edges, just like they do on these other issues. But at the end of the day, you know, we're stuck with a consensus that what we need to do is just do everything we can to extract every resource and just burn the hell out of the atmosphere as fast as we can. And, you know, and it's all based on the most faulty premise you could base it on, which is the idea that, you know, that somehow doing that will change gas prices, which is just complete BS, as, you know, as we all know. I mean, you know, we are in a world market, and the fact that gas price, that, you know, somebody's building a pipeline somewhere in North Dakota is not going to make a difference in gas prices. It's ridiculous.
It is strange how there was a sort of like understood, you know, when President Obama said, you know, I also believe in a all of the above strategy. Well, why? You know, I mean, it's like, you know, when Romney says, and honestly, like, I thought it was, I couldn't, it was, when Romney went into that, you're not Mr. Coal, Mr. Oil, Mr. Natural Gas.
That?
I just literally, it was one of those things, like, it needed 30 seconds to catch up to me. Like, he didn't just actually use that construct. Like, you think you missed the big guy who likes coal so much that we should call you Mr. Coal? There was an opportunity, I think, for President Obama, but they, I mean, obviously this is a conscious choice to say, well, you know, there is this thing called global warming. And, you know, I understand on one hand we have to balance our approach. I mean, I'm just coming up with the sort of the most cautious construction of this. But it is fascinating that there has been a what seems to be a categorical avoidance of this issue by the president, and which, you know, I guess this is an egg and chicken type of question, but also by the moderators. I mean, you know, presumably one of those hundreds of people who put in questions said, hey, this whole thing where we're having droughts and, you know, you've got now equine encephalitis is sort of seems to be growing, or, you know, whatever it is, the hottest 12 months in a row since anybody has been recording these things. You would imagine someone would have brought that up, but I guess Candy Crowley was like, eh, we're not going to resolve that.
Right. Well, and there seems to be some, and I mean, I hopefully I'm wrong, but there seems to be some consensus developing that this is, that nothing's going to happen here, so let's just not deal with this. We're not going to do it. There's no point in it. You know, you've got the climate change denialists, you know, on the one side, and you've got the scientists on the other, and, you know, this is one of those he said, she said that we're just not going to resolve. And the Democrats, instead of, you know, seeing this as a vital issue, that, you know, I realize we have an economic problem, but that's not going to, you know, resolving the economic problem isn't going to change this one. And the idea that you can just ignore it is, you know, actually rather, you know, well, irresponsible is too mild of a word. I mean, it's absolutely, it's completely immoral, really. And, you know, and meanwhile, you know, this is at the same time where everybody's, you know, clutching their pearls and going to the fainting couch over deficit projections 40 years from now that aren't going to be true. But meanwhile, this one we're just going to leave on the table. I don't understand it. I mean, I must be missing some information here. You know, there must be something that they're getting from polling or focus groups that may, that's scaring them off about this, that it makes them sound like, you know, like hippies or something.
Right.
That,
tree huggers.
You know, Yeah, tree huggers and Pinot, and people don't like it. And, you know, I mean, Mitt did some of the old stuff last night talking about how he stopped a pipeline for some wild birds, you know, that kind of, you know, right. throwback cretinous crap that, you know, they've been saying that for years. But now, you know, the context that this is being discussed, in which this is being discussed, is really quite, you know, catastrophic. And the idea that they are, neither the media or the politicians seem inclined to talk about it. I mean, I just keep getting that gun control feeling that they, you know, that they're just, it's like after 2000 when the whole Democratic Party just threw up their hands and said, okay, well, that's done. They won, we lost, move on.
Yeah, the bird was, I guess, the 2012 version of the spotted owl, right? I
mean, that was exactly.
And so what do you make of, I mean, there were a couple of things, too, that I was sort of surprised. And, you know, We heard the 47%, and it was brought up, I think, at a great time in some respects. But we never heard the words Bain capital, which seems to me to be weird, because Newt Gingrich had pretty successfully villainized Bain. We never really heard – there was only one, I think, literally like one reference to Republicans in Congress. No mention of really the Ryan budget that much. What do you think this was all by design? I mean, those to me strike me as going to the heart of trying to make Mitt Romney seem extreme, because we know what Republicans do. We've had an example, and he is the Republican nominee.
Well, I was surprised by that because, you know, I had understood that one of the rules of these debates, one of the things that politicians are supposed to always do, is to, you know, emphasize what they're already saying on the ground, which is that, you know, what it does is it just pushes out their ads and pushes out their, you know, their stump speeches and everything they're already saying. They want to, this is a national audience, and they have, and they're there facing the other, you know, the other guy at that point, that they're always supposed to emphasize that. And, you know, Obama has been pushing the Bain thing like crazy, especially in this, you know, in the vital swing states like Ohio, and it's been very successful. You know, he portrayed Bain for months and portrayed Romney for months and months and months as, you know, the boss from hell. And that works really well with, you know, people in places like Ohio who have some experience with bosses from hell. And, you know, they're kind of, that's a working class sort of trope that really does work. And he'd been doing that the whole time. And, you know, all of the things that you mentioned have been part of the campaign. So the fact that they didn't come up in the debate, it's hard for me to believe that they consciously did that. Why would they do that? I mean, unless the guys, you know, David Plouffe and the rest, Axelrod and the rest of these guys are, you know, once again believing that they don't need to, you know, that they're
they have to be erring on this notion of, like, we're going to keep the president in this type of forum looking presidential. And when he's out on the stump, he's out on the stump. I mean, I understand that theory. I mean, I think it's.
Well, he doesn't have to scream it or come out with one-liners or anything, but just to mention it, and especially if you can refer to these things in a you know, sort of subtle or a kind of, you know, in passing, in a way that sort of evokes what people have already heard about Bain and about this. I mean, I don't really get it. I mean, you know, what do I know? I'm no expert on this, but it struck me as well that these were very successful. These were very successful campaigns, and they were focused in places where the president really needs to win. I assume people in Ohio were watching the debate, you know, and it places where, you know, things have tightened in the last months, that he really needs to, you know, kind of get his message, you know, compound it home. I would have assumed that he would do that. But, you know, maybe they had just decided that he did need to stay above the fray, and that these ads that are being played endlessly in states where at the end he says, you know, I'm Barack Obama and I approve this message, that somehow people won't associate them with him. But I don't really think that's, you know, that's possible.
I want to ask you about just sort of, I mean, I think President Obama, obviously Mitt Romney's, and this is being played over and over again, is the sort of the Libyan exchange and sort of how Romney, you know, just pulled the biggest blunder that you can do in any, really any context, which is to sort of trumpet a something that is sort of so obviously false that you actually function as a catalyst to the moderator from CNN having to step in and go, well, actually, you're not telling the truth. I mean, when that happens, you know you have a massive problem because they barely do that on their own newscasts. But what does it say about the how much the right still dominates the media narrative that Libya has played such a big role in this? I mean, Afghanistan doesn't even come up, right? I mean, we're losing, we're still losing troops in Afghanistan. We still have tens of thousands of troops there. This is, we're still engaged in a full-on war. How is it just simply because the CNN has to feel, or any of these media outlets have to feel like we got to push the Libya thing because that's what, you know, Breitbart is, Breitbart.com is writing about every day?
You know, short answer is yes, what you said. they you know, the right is still very, very adept at playing the refs on this stuff. And they seized on this Benghazi thing. And it's so funny because the truth was it was Romney who came out after the Benghazi attack and made the biggest blunder.
Right.
And in an attempt to cover that up and to, you know, shift attention away, they managed to gin up, you know, it's really quite a classic right-wing, you know, a right-wing media pseudo-scandal. You know, the truth of the matter is that after the attacks, there was a lot of confusion. Nobody really knew what had precipitated it. They knew, yes, the president had said and acknowledged it was an act of terror, which, of course, it was. It wasn't an accident. Of course it was an act of terror. And, you know, it clearly wasn't something that, you know, so it just, you know, but there was a lot of misinformation. Everybody was saying different things. You know, this is, you know, let's go take a look at the 9/11 report if you want to, you know, see an example of how that works. So, you know, they managed, though, to seize on that and pivot away from their guys, you know, really outrageous blunder and turn this into some kind of a scandal. As I keep saying every time I hear about it, which is constantly, who cares?
Right.
Who cares what he said? Why is this even an issue? Yes, embassies in hot spots like that get attacked by whomever all the time. It happened way more, by the way, during Reagan, Bush Sr., and Clinton than it has in the last couple of administrations, weirdly enough. And yet, you know, somehow or another, they've managed to turn this into a real controversy. It's kind of amazing. I think it's going to be a case study of how that happened. How they, you know, back in the old days, they used to funnel it through the foreign press, and then it would come back in through Drudge, and then the mainstream media in the U.S. would pick these things up. I think it's different now. The funneling comes through the blogs, talk radio, and some other things. But whatever the case, yes. You know, they felt like they had to, you know, they feel as if they have to cover this. Now, CNN is an interesting case study all in itself because they pride themselves on their foreign coverage and, you know, they had to, you know, pretend like they cared about this and that this was a major. So, I mean, note, by the way, that, you know, all the major explosion in the Middle East as a result of this whole thing that the right was anticipating has not happened. So, you know, whatever. But, you know, they're very, very good at this, and it's appalling to me that the mainstream press, despite fact-checking, despite all this, even despite Candy Crowley, you know, basically having to come out and go, well, you know, sorry, Governor, he did actually say act of terror, it doesn't stop it.
Well, it's interesting because as far as I can tell, in the wake of what happened in Libya, the biggest story seems to be that the civilian population of Benghazi drove the militias, or at least the ones that were perceived to have participated in that, out of Benghazi. I mean, that seems to be a fairly positive almost surprising sign in some respects, which seems to have just been completely lost in the ether. I don't know. I find that very strange. I mean, CNN, I think, is a unique case, both because of the foreign stuff and I think also because, frankly, they made, I think, a strategic business decision to sort of chase after more Tea Party money, frankly. And I don't know how well that's working out for them. But one other thing I want to just touch on, too, is there has not been, and we're having a foreign policy debate, I guess it's next week. My prediction is that an hour into that, no one is watching, short of people like us. I mean, the American public seems to be completely uninterested in foreign policy, and there doesn't seem to be any, you know, grounding on much of it. It's all going to be supposedly, I guess, about Iran, right, and more Libya talk. But we will have gone through three debates, assuming Bob Schieffer continues just to do foreign policy next week, and not a single question about the Supreme Court.
Well, that's interesting, and boy, is there ever, you know, I mean, I feel sometimes like I'm, you know, the boy crying wolf with the Supreme Court because, you know, liberals have every election for God knows how long said, you know, but what, you know, if they get the hold of the Supreme Court, look what's going to happen. But this time it's really for real. You know, this time it's not just crying wolf, I swear to God, because, you know, the two, you know, most elderly Supreme Court justice, I mean, they literally cannot last forever. I mean, I wish they could, because I think that, you know, that they are, you know, the best. But they're both on the left. If they are replaced by Mitt Romney, and I have no doubt, none whatsoever, that he will appoint the most far-right judges that he can possibly get through there without a second thought. I mean, this is, you know, their legacy. The right-wing movement's legacy, they will demand it, and he will have no choice. And, you know, if we think the Roberts Court is bad already, and it is, and it has pretty much a five, you know, justice majority at this point, five-vote majority, you know, imagine what it's going to be like if there are two more Scalia's on the court.
Right.
It is a big issue, and it hasn't come up. I mean, there have been a bunch of issues that haven't come up. You know, last night there was one immigration question. It was sort of a perfunctory question, which Romney got to accuse Obama of failing to pass immigration reform, and that's what everybody left the debate thinking was true, because Obama failed to say, well, you know, you guys, you know, the Republican Congress is really the, you know, the ones with the problem here. But, you know, nonetheless, you know, the there are certain issues that I think that they're extremely important: climate change, Supreme Court, immigration, that got short shrift, as well as reproductive rights, which really didn't get any discussion. You know, Obama pivoted that one to, well, women need birth control so they can work,
right,
which isn't bad, you know, but it doesn't address it head on.
Yeah, I thought those things were fascinating in that respect. That their absence in this, and they're also, you know, issues that seem to play. Atrios had a great sort of short post on this. You know, things like the idea that gay marriage, marriage equality, you know, don't ask, don't tell issues. I guess it's all been resolved in the country now.
Well, we're done.
Done. But any of these issues that might benefit the left in terms of a discussion, right? I mean, abortion theoretically it's still contentious, but I mean, hasn't this been settled the law now for 30 some odd years, 40 some odd years? And but we still this is still brought up with some frequency. It's just interesting that we see it less when these are issues that benefit the left. But, you know, I guess.
Well, I've been interested, you know, on the sort of, you know, broader point that, you know, 5 years ago, all we could talk about was foreign policy. I mean, it was like the most important thing. We, you know, George Bush was a colossus on the world stage. He was, you know, striding around, putting America, you know, back on top. This was all we cared about. You know, now that Obama has done what, you know, Democrats always say they want to do, which is, you know, gain credibility on that subject by, you know, killing bin Laden with his bare hands. Mm-hmm. You know, now that he's done all that, no one gives a shit.
Right.
Excuse me. No one gives a damn about foreign policy. By the same token, you know, now that it, you know, it's to Democrats, you know, advantage, you know, to the Republicans' advantage to talk about, you know, how Obama's failed because the economy is bad. Suddenly, that's a big issue that we're going to, you know, talk about. Not to say that these issues aren't equal, you know, aren't always important on some level. They always are. But it's interesting how the emphasis seems to go always to the advantage of the Republicans, regardless of what's, you know, of what's actually happening. So my point is that when Democrats are sort of quixotically attempting to gain credibility on the deficit or gain credibility on foreign policy so they can, quote, take it off the table, guess what? You never get to take it off the table because it'll come back on the table the minute it benefits the Republicans to come back on the table. So forget that. Nobody's going to ever, you know, give you credit for the things that you did in the past or the things that you've done, that you've accomplished, if it's to their benefit not to do that. I just think that whole line of thinking, and I think Obama buys into it with his grand bargain. Mm-hmm. Certainly Bill Clinton, you know, says it every 5 minutes, and it just never works out. You know, I mean, remember, Clinton was going to retire he had retired the idea that Democrats were tax and spend and were bad fiscal stewards. How'd that work out for us?
Right,
you know,
not
where
too
are
well.
We today? Yeah,
indeed.
Exactly.
And I don't know. It's going to be fascinating to see what this foreign policy debate is going to, what the topics are going to be. And I mean, I don't know where Obama, I mean, are you going to hear Mitt Romney talk about China, 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 and Libya, right? I mean, is there any, and Iran, I guess. But it's all just going to seem so hollow in some respects. But,
well, I heard Romney read a book about Russia, so maybe we'll hear something about that. Remember, he said recently that Russia was our greatest, you know, the greatest threat to America because he just read a book about it. So
that's the thing.
Yeah,
I think there's going to be a lot of moments where the vast amount of the American public is going to be looking at their TV with just sort of their mouth agape, just going like, what? 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 But.
I hope so. That'll make it sort of fun for me.
Yes.
You know, I don't know how good it is for America, but I'll enjoy that.
Well, Digby from the blog, hullabaloo at digbysblog.blogspot.com. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Sam.
All right, folks. Oh, wow. I didn't realize. We went a little long there. All right, that is lesser half of our program today. We're going to move into the better half of the program. You can call us 646-257-3920. A couple of programming notes. If you're a member, you will be able to download the debate coverage from last night as an additional bonus. Yeah, that's right. 6 episodes last week of the show, 6 episodes this week of the membership show. So if you're inclined to send me an email, I'm not going to say your name, person who you know who I'm referring to, and saying, hey, will you do it? Take it off all this time. Members got 6 episodes last week. Members are going to get 6 episodes this week. Give me a break. It's unbelievable.
And on the occasions where we don't have a live show, members always get a show.
That's right. And sometimes it's like special debate bonuses. You know what? Actually, next week, yes, they will be, oh my God, it's possible they may have 7 shows because I'm doing that debate. Wow. That's the problem. That dude who you know who I'm referring to, who emailed me.
I know who you're referring to.
That really stuck in my craw because I'm fried. Frying, you know, like doing shows from over a 12-hour span, 2 shows, one end on each end of the 12 hours, plus the prep and whatnot. People are complaining. Yeah, I'm sorry. The internet went out yesterday. You can become a member at majority.fm, even if you can't handle 6 shows a week. double the time. You get to pick and choose what shows you want. We give a breakdown of what takes place during the better half of the program that we post on the blog. So some days you come in, you go, you know what? I just don't have time to watch it. Oh, but wait a second. I got to listen to this. And then even if you don't listen to the full show, you're supporting the first half of the show. So,
and the archives are always available for you to go back and get whatever you want at any time.
That's right. And soon, after the election, we will hopefully be able to set up the old Majority Report archive, which will be searchable, and where you can go in and get the MP3s from that as well.
Majority Report Classic.
Yeah, exactly. Bingo. All right, folks. Tomorrow on the program, Chrystia Freeland will be here on her. I don't know if the book has come out yet, but she's one of the best reporters when it comes to sort of hobnobbing with the billionaires. And they keep talking to her even after she reports on what they write. It's not flattering. But she will be joining us tomorrow. And in the better half of the program today, you can call in 646-257-3920. We'll take your IMs. We want to hear your debate reactions. We've got some clips. We'll play some clips. Just in case you were wondering, Sean Hannity, last night, Mitt Romney delivered his best debate performance ever. Oh, you know what maybe we'll do in the better half? If I can do it, if I can rig it.
Random rush?
Yeah, if we can get it going. I don't know where the... See if I can get the radio cranked up.
Why don't you pull it up on your iPad?
Nah, I can't stream that down there for some reason. What's that?
No, just that's a great idea. If we can do it.
Okay, great. See you in the better half, folks.